Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. We're now on episode number 689. My name is Camden Busey, and I'm here in Grays Lake, Illinois, at the Reformed Forum studio, desirous of talking about some important matters. I've been waiting on this one for a little while, and we're really excited to talk today to our friend way overseas and in the other hemisphere, Dr. Christopher Watkin, who serves as a lecturer at Monash University in Melbourne. He's also on a four-year research fellowship looking at the social contract. Welcome back, Chris. It's so good to see you today.
Hi, Camden. It's been a while, hasn't it? I'm really glad to be back.
Yes. Well, we're glad to have you and glad that we can connect. And I mean, I never cease to be amazed at how this does work, that we can speak with people overseas, whether in the UK or Australia, particularly the larger English-speaking populations we end up speaking with overseas. And even 10, 15 years ago, we wouldn't be able to do something like this. So we're thankful for that. And even though we're on other sides of the day, we're hopefully on the same page here as we're going to be speaking about Michel Foucault. Foucault is an enormous titan of an intellectual figure. And we're going to be speaking about this book that I'm holding up for those watching the video, which is in the Great Thinkers series. Dr. Watkin has written the volume on Foucault. He's also written volumes on Jacques Derrida and Gilles Deleuze, which is the most recent one. I need to get a copy of that myself. Looking forward to reading that and studying that. But we're going to be tackling Foucault. Before I even get started, Chris, I just want to provide a little bit of a background to listeners so that they might, you know, there might be some who are hesitant or don't know who Foucault is or why they should care. I had heard the name and whatnot, was relatively semi-familiar with who Foucault was through, you know, just some general materials on post-structuralism and the general orbit of post-modernism. I took a course on missions with Harvey Kahn via tape. He was deceased at the time, but you know, I still received the tapes, and so I listened to his lectures, and he lectured a little bit on Foucault in that period as it pertained to mission contextualization, all those sorts of things. And read a very short introduction, I think, from Oxford on post-structuralism. But it was my time studying at Temple University for the PhD program at Westminster. We had to take two external courses. And one was that I decided to take at Temple was on continental philosophy. They have a very accomplished continental or philosophy department that focuses on continental philosophy. I took a course on just general continental philosophy, hoping we would cover Heidegger. But we only ended up covering Foucault. The professor just wanted to cover Foucault that semester. So we were even talking, Chris, beforehand. At the time, I was a little disappointed, thinking maybe not entirely a waste of my time. I was interested. I was engaged, but I was wondering, you know, maybe I could have spent my time better. But now I'm reaping dividends because Foucault has re-entered the public discourse in a big way. I don't know about how things are going precisely in Australia on the cultural front, but here in America, certainly when people are talking about this crisis and this transformation of our self-conception and identity, thinking about lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender issues and all that's involved, deep at the heart of that in many cases, particularly with regard to critical theory and all of that atmosphere, milieu, is the figure Foucault. So I'm going to hold up a book here for those who want to see what he looks like. He's got a nice head, you know, akin to mine, but a very different man, I hope to say. So we have some wonderful books here, Chris, but I'd love for you to just explain, like, how did you get introduced to Foucault? How did it come about that you would write the Great Thinkers volume on this important thinker?
Yeah, thank you, Camden. I guess my first introduction to Foucault was as an undergraduate. In my second year at Cambridge, we did a unit, the best unit I ever took. It's a mind-blowing unit. It's called Modern Critical Theory.
Oh, yeah.
Critical theory in the broad sense, not just the Frankfurt School, but we did Deleuze, Derrida, Edward Said, we did Foucault. And I only did one essay on Foucault, but I got the sense that there was a very broad research agenda that he was pursuing, and it was power particularly that I was looking at, the theme of power in that essay. And it was only later when I returned to him, I'd written the Great Thinker's book on Derrida, and I thought that was such a productive exercise for me, and it helped me in my own thinking. I thought, who else could I do? And it didn't take me long, really, to realize that if I didn't do Foucault, that would be a huge omission, given just the footprint that he has, both in philosophy, but also beyond. I've got a friend who was, I chatted to about the Foucault book when I was writing it, and he said, hey, my son is at university doing geography at the moment, and Foucault is all over the geography course.
Oh, wow.
He's in sociology. He's all over the arts and humanities. And one thing that really made my jaw drop, I knew he was important, but I didn't realize until I did a bit of research for the book that he's actually the most cited author, according to Google Scholar, among all authors of all time. He outstrips Freud. He outstrips Marx. He outstrips Einstein. He is the most cited author on Google Scholar. And so that just gives you a sense of the breadth of his influence on the way that we think today. His footprint is huge.
Wow. I'm looking up Foucault right now on Google Scholar to say, I wonder what his, what do they call that? The H rank? His H index is 300. That is insane. That is... So if I'm not mistaken, this is, it seems a little bit of an opaque number, but this is really nerdy because now we're getting into like baseball stats for scholars. So that
this is my home territory, Camden. We can do this all day.
I imagine
so that
figures
means
into
300 papers,
right,
that have been cited 300 times
each. Yes.
Oh yeah.
So if your H index is one, that means somebody cited one of your papers once. That would be that's good. but a 300 is astronomical. That would be like batting in baseball, American baseball. That'd be like finishing the year batting 600 or something, which is just off. It's mind blowing. Or in international football,
in
scoring
Europe, this is Brian Lara's 300.
There we go. Or maybe, you know, in the international soccer, in football, you know, averaging two goals a game or something like that, which is just never unheard of. So Foucault is enormous. But the question then that arises is why? And we'll get into that as we unfold this. Why has he been received as such an important figure? Why do people continue to interact with his writing? So his H rank or his H index since 2016. Now he's been dead for decades, but his H index is still 197. So it's picking up steam. But Foucault was an important figure in his own life, his own time. He did several high profile interviews. I remember seeing one. I think you can even find it on YouTube where he's doing public debates with Noam Chomsky, among other people. So, what can you tell us a bit about Foucault's life, his dates, and even his popularity and influence even while he was alive?
Yeah, sure. Well, his dates are born in 1926, died 1984. And that sort of puts him in this 1968 generation of French thinkers who were relatively sort of coming onto the scene, becoming influential around those French riots of students and workers in 1968, when the de Gaulle government was almost overthrown. So he is a member of what is very loosely called the counterculture from that point of view. Look, I think if we want to get a handle on the way that he's shaped the way that we think, I think we need three words, because there are three periods roughly in his thinking. Early on, he's thinking about history and he's trying to challenge the way that we understand history. His middle period, he's thinking about power and he wants to revolutionize our understanding of the way power works in society. And then in his later work, he's talking about identity and how identity is constructed and how it ought to be constructed. So it's history, power, and identity.
Wow. What are some of his major works that fall within there? I should mention that at the end of your Great Thinkers volume, you have a very helpful chart that helps sketch this out for folks. But for if people would like to maybe pick up a few Foucault titles to begin with, primary sources at least, you can find a whole ton of secondary sources and introductions But what are some of his major titles that fall within those different eras of his own thinking?
Yeah, great question. Look, I think for the early stuff on history, you'd probably want to look at the history of madness. You've got to be careful. Okay, we're going to get nerdy again for a moment.
Here. Sure.
That there are two versions of it. There's mm-hmm. Madness and Civilization, which was published quite a while ago. It's actually incomplete. It's not a full translation of the French Folie des Raisons. So try and get hold of the History of Madness, which is a more recent translation that's actually the full text. For his middle period on power, I think that the key text there is Discipline and Punish, where he steps through the different regimes of power that have characterized our society. And then for Identity, you probably want to look at the first volume of his History of Sexuality.
Yeah, and he certainly contributes an enormous amount there. That might be one of the places where he's most significant, where interaction with his thought is certainly picking up steam. So within those three segments, what might we say are his specific contributions, specifically looking early on at his section of history? What is Foucault introducing, and what's he interested in at that time?
We have an understanding of history, sort of an intuitive sense of how history goes, which is basically a story, isn't it? And in the modern world, it's a story of progress. So we used to be superstitious and believe in all these nonsense gods. But thank goodness the Enlightenment says that we've got rid of that. And through technology and through reason, we're becoming more and more advanced. And people used to think that eventually we'll perfect ourselves. I don't think people tend to think that anymore. But there's still this idea of progress, that history is a story. Foucault says that is wrong, actually. And he sees history as a series of ruptures. So it's not one nice progression from stage to stage over time, but it's just a series of different ways of looking at the world. In some of his writing, he calls these epistemes, different frameworks for understanding reality. And we tend to think of history, I think, as a series of great influential people. You know, we've got Martin Luther King, who you know, is a wonderful I Have a Dream speech, transformed society and so forth. Foucault's not interested in people. He's interested in concepts. So the way that he puts it is, I don't want a philosophy of consciousness. I want a philosophy of concepts. And it's the ideas that we have, our mental furniture, if you like, that shape history, not individual people doing wonderful things. And he's also not particularly bothered, and this will sound really strange, about what was said in any particular period of history. And you think, well, how can you do history without paying attention to what was said?
Yeah.
He focuses on what it was possible to say at any particular period in history. What our concepts allowed us to think. So in his early writing on madness, for example, he will say that at one particular point in history, you've got a concept like unreason in the modern, early modern period. And he says into that concept, you throw all sorts of different groups of people. You throw people who today we would classify as having mental illness. You also throw vagabonds and other groups of people. And within that way of looking at the world, you just can't think mental illness in the way we do now. You just don't have that category. You have different categories with different shapes to them. And what he's interested in are the shapes of these categories, what your concepts allow you to think at a particular period, regardless of what people actually did with those concepts. So philosophy of ruptures, philosophy of concepts, and a philosophy of epistemes, which is what it's possible to say rather than what actually was said. And that's how Foucault wants to try and rethink history for us.
Yeah, I remember, you know, discussing this at length in the course I took. I thought it was fascinating. And there seemed to be a lot of at least formal similarities with other thinkers that people might be familiar with. I'd be curious to see. We don't have to dive down deep and compare and contrast at great length every single thing. But One figure that sticks out to me is Thomas Kuhn and his understanding of paradigms and paradigm shifts, in particularly in his very classic book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, where science doesn't progress at just a straight increase. You have these ruptures or drastic shifts at times where the total paradigm changes. The great example, of course, is the Copernican Revolution. But we also have some at least formal similarities with our understandings of worldview, whether those are, that's an idealist version coming from the philosophers of the Enlightenment, or a more chastened and biblically formed neo-Calvinist variety, something that we might find in Cornelius Van Til, who understands that we think God's thoughts after him on a created level. There's a structure and a form. And then the last is I think it was Peter Berger, I might be mistaken, a Lutheran theologian / sociologist who presented this notion of a plausibility structure. I don't know if you're familiar with any of those presentations, but do we find some overlap with Foucault on these things, or is he doing something categorically different? What might you say here to help us all and all of our listeners, you know, be able to find the hooks upon which we could hang some of Foucault's ideas?
That is an extremely helpful question, Camden. The master interviewer strikes.
Well,
yeah, that is a great way to situate him, isn't it? Let me try and run through those three analogies that you drew there and try and tease out some similarities and differences. So the first one was Kuhn. Yes, there is certainly overlap in the sense that you don't get a smooth, gradual, constant progression over time. You get these leaps and jumps. But I think he would differ from Kuhn in that in Kuhn, there's still a sense of progress and an asymptotic approximation to reality. So, you know, so for the Copernican Revolution, the Copernicus is better than Ptolemy. He gives us better predictability about the movement of the heavenly bodies. And similarly, Einstein is better than Newton. You can predict more things more accurately with Einstein than you can with Newton. So there's still a sense in Kuhn of gradual, even if it's stepwise, progress. Whereas Foucault is very reluctant to make that sort of judgment. Mm. It's a complex issue in Foucault because he does have political commitments as mm-hmm. well, which put him in a very awkward situation with regard to some of his way that he understands history. But fundamentally, he doesn't want to say that the way of looking at the world in one period is better than the way of looking at the world in the other, for the very good reason that each way of looking at the world has its own criterion of success. So it would sort of be like us saying football is a far superior game to baseball because in football you score touchdowns. You know, you say, well, obviously, like that's, yeah, you're just judging it by a standard that comes from football. Right. So that, and he would say that's all you can do. You can only judge something from a standard that comes from within one of mm. these ways of looking at the world. And you're always going to come out on top if you choose your standard. The second comparison that you drew there was with Van Til. And similarly, I think there's certainly overlap in the sense that a global way of looking at the world brings with it its own standards. But of course, Van Til it has a very strong idea that there is one way of looking at the world
right.
that actually right. cuts with the grain of reality. Mm-hmm. One can think God's thoughts after him, precisely. And Foucault has no such idea that there's one episteme that is sort of the royal road to connecting with reality as it really is. So that would be the big difference there between Van Til and Foucault. And then you mentioned plausibility structures and Berger. Again, similarly, I think there's a lot of overlap between Foucault's idea of epistemes and Berger's plausibility structures. I think that the differences would come out when you drill a little bit further down there. So, you know, Foucault is very much concerned with concepts, not consciousness, what was possible to say rather than what was said. And I don't think Berger would travel that road with him. So Foucault has this, for people who are sort of into this thing, this Bachelardian, he gets it from Gaston Bachelard, this idea of history as concepts rather than consciousness. And I don't think Berger would buy that.
Wow. You know, it's interesting to situate Foucault within the history of ideas himself, and just to, you know, that's something that I thought was so fascinating to me. I had read quite a bit of continental other philosophers, but not Foucault, not a whole lot in the postmodern vein. So I was, you know, reading more guys like Hegel, Heidegger, you know, some Kant, you know, just come at things much differently. So a more modern, contemporary type of approach, to me, it's interesting to see how they react to some of these big thinkers. So if listeners have not read more contemporary, and again, Foucault passed away in 1984, so we're starting to get more and more dated. To me, that still seems contemporary in the history of ideas. But but if you haven't read those, it's important to do so, but also to realize what they're reacting to. So Foucault has his own history, so to speak. But
you mentioned Hegel there, and I think it's just worthwhile for our listeners just tightening up on his relation to Hegel and Marx, because I think there's a sense sometimes today that all of these thinkers are basically Marxists, and for Foucault this really isn't the case, and I think it's quite helpful to understand why. So Marx gets his idea of history from Hegel in part, and it's very much this idea of progress. For Hegel, there's a sense of the inevitable realization of what he calls Geist, spirit, mm-hmm. in history. History is all about this story in which Geist realizes itself. So it's a big, long connected idea with one driving force behind it. And Marx takes that on. He gets rid of the idea of Geist, a little bit too metaphysical. He makes it materialist, and he says history is a big story all about the overthrow of the bourgeoisie, the capitalist bourgeoisie, by the proletariat. He says it's inevitable, it certainly will happen, and that is the meaning of history. And Foucault says, rubbish. That is sort of an unjustified big story that you've just tried to stick onto history. When we look at history, what we find is just a series of ruptures. And power doesn't work in the way that Marx thinks it does, with huge sort of big overturnings and sort of this big picture idea of the rise of the proletariat. Foucault rejects all of that. So he's quite virulently anti-Marxist in his view of history.
So this being a little cheeky, if people are in America are so complaining about the socialists and Marxists for political reasons, anyone they don't agree with, they'll call them a Marxist. You know, does that mean that they should be friends of Foucault?
It means they shouldn't put Foucault in that same bucket.
I gotcha.
You know, we can very legitimately have issues with him, but that isn't one of them.
Yeah, absolutely. What about Foucault's interaction with power? He deals with power a lot. I have a big fat reader of him dealing with power. There's a phrase that he often interacts with and that's attached to him called biopower. And we're not talking, you know, green energy instead of fossil fuels. We're talking about something quite different. What are some of Foucault's contributions here? Help us orient us towards some of these.
Yeah. So the first thing to get our heads around is that power isn't just one thing for Foucault. So when we think of power in society, we probably think of the government or the police, you know, top down power dictating to people what they can do and what they can't do and locking them up in prison if they don't do the right thing, that sort of thing. For Foucault, that's only one sort of power, and it's probably not the most interesting sort of power. He calls that sovereign power. And he says that was the primary type of power up until about the 17th century. So you had this monarch at the top of society, and the monarch basically could say, I'm going to make you now fight in my army. I'm going to take your taxes away from you. I'm going to exert that sort of sovereign power over you. But basically, the monarch left you alone unless he or she needed you for your body in the army or for your taxes. And he says what happened is, as we get into the modern age, there's a new sort of power, a subtler sort of power that emerges in society, and he calls it disciplinary power. Mm-hmm. And he says its paradigm is the military parade ground. So before this period, armies were just mobs, basically, that rampaged around and didn't have a great deal of training. But now people realize that efficiency is the key to military victory. If you can load and fire a musket quicker than the enemy, there's a good chance you're going to beat them. And if you're more organized than the enemy, there's a good chance you're going to beat them. And so you start drilling very precise movements on the military parade ground. Everybody stands exactly the same. Everybody moves at exactly the same time. And you refine and make efficient, as efficient as you can, all those movements. And he says that idea of disciplining the body and of regulating its movements actually filters out into the whole of society. And so you get a very regimented timekeeping regime that comes in this period as well. And you have schools where the body is disciplined as well. You sit down at the same time, you stand up at the same time, you only speak when you're spoken to. And this idea of disciplinary power is much more, he calls it capillary. You imagine thousands and thousands of little capillaries in the body. It's not one huge artery coming down from the monarch, but it's lots of institutions in society, all disciplining your body, essentially, in particular ways to make it more efficient. And so the value of efficiency comes through very strongly at this period. And then later on, you get the idea of biopower, as you mentioned earlier, coming in, which is a much more, a much stronger sense of allowing someone to live until and unless that becomes inefficient for society. And so the control in each of these steps becomes more, if you like, invasive. It might look less spectacular, you know, so the monarch torturing people because they're seditious or whatever is very dramatic, but the monarch leaves you alone for most of your life. Mm-hmm. That was the sovereign power. In disciplinary power, it starts to become much more what you do in your everyday life is controlled and is subject to power and subject to what Foucault calls normalization. You're made to conform to the norm. And then biopower again is even more intrusive. So Foucault says it looks like we're freer than we've ever been in society, but actually power is much more insidious now and gets into our bones much more now than it has done in the past.
Yeah, I think I really enjoyed this portion of the book, your book, and I think it's a fascinating area for exploration. I have this running list of ideas. Someday maybe I'll write about this, that, or the other, but I often never get to it. So I'll throw it out to the listeners if they want to pursue. But I think it'd be fascinating to read a little essay or something on Foucault and then the Westminster Standards conception of the Fifth Commandment. As we talk about the shorter and the larger catechism, as they explicate the Ten Commandments and the Fifth Commandment, of course, honor your father and your mother. But it speaks about responsibilities of superiors to inferiors and inferiors to superiors. So the notion of responsibility and authority and power is much broader and bidirectional, bilateral. It's a web of networks when you start to multiply that throughout a society. And then you also start to include institutions and rightful authorities within a society and governments, all those sorts of things. It's a fascinating thing to pursue. And Foucault has a lot of thought and he's very provocative on these issues. And if for nothing else, you read him, you'll think more deeply and try to understand what a Christian response to power is, or at least ought to be. Power is tremendous there. Do you find that people are still interacting much on the power subject, or is this with Foucault or with history, or do you think it happens to be mostly in the area of sexual identity and ethics?
Look, I think he's still influential across the board. There's obviously a lot of work being done at the moment on sexuality and queer theory and things like that. But that doesn't mean that we've forgotten the earlier Foucault. And I think it's worth keeping all of these three periods of his output in mind, because I think he has got provocative things to say in each of them. And so just to pick up on this idea of power in the Westminster Confession, you got me thinking now.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that you'd want to say And it would be a point at which Foucault, I think, would be walking alongside a Christian idea of power, is that power isn't always bad. And this is really important for Foucault. Some people hear the word power and they think only oppression, only me being stopped from doing what I want by some authority outside of me. And that's very much not the way he sees power at all. He sees us as being not threatened from the outside by power, but constituted by power. We're built by power relations. They go all the way down and all the way back in us. And they're not necessarily bad. He's very reluctant to define power because he wants to let it sort of emerge in each context. But at one point he says it's power is action upon the action of others. And you know, that's quite a neutral thing. That can be oppressive, but it can also be constitutive of who we are. You know, the action of parents upon children, children upon parents, God through his law upon a people shapes that people from the inside. It is your identity. It's not that your identity fights against that power, but your identity is shaped in part by that power. And so I think that's one of the points that I would make if I was writing your dream essay.
Well, that's a great point. Yeah. So I'll look forward to you sending me your manuscript when you're done with that. But yeah, Foucault, it's interesting to think about all the context and domains and just, you know, we sometimes tend to be very reductionistic and think these types of people have power. These other types of people are subject to them. But you might even take the same two people and you might have a, everyone's probably experienced this, but let's say, you know, you have a supervisor at work. Your supervisor, your boss has power, a certain type of power and authority over you in a certain context. But now let's say that you, you know, that supervisor, you know, visits some sort of club that you're a part of or jumps into your community of friends for a time, he's in a different domain or she's in a different domain. And now there's a whole different set of dynamics and power structures. That's just one very simple example where Foucault helps broaden our vision and our contemplation over these matters to see this entire web or network of structures that goes throughout society. And that's one thing I'm very appreciative to him for, even though I don't always, and in many ways, rarely agree with his conclusions. It's still worth engaging with.
Absolutely. I think you're getting a bit Hegelian on me there, Cameron. Well, I think what we're inching towards here is Hegel's idea of the master-slave dialectic, which is that if you've got someone who's in authority, the master, and someone who's under authority, the slave, there's actually a mutual dependence. The master needs the slave, in a sense, even more than the slave needs the master, because without the slave, the master wouldn't be a master. So he or she is desperately invested in keeping the slave going as a slave in order to sustain their own mastery. And so these relationships of power are really complex. It's not just that some in power who are not subject to power exert it over all the others who are.
Yeah.
It goes lots of different ways. And that's why I love this capillary image. Mm-hmm. The capillaries go all over in lots of different directions, lots of tiny little dynamics of power.
Before we get to issues regarding sexual ethics and that sort of thing, which is a third segment here that we want to address. On the Hegelian point, and to echo some of the Marxist point, do you find that these three segments of Foucault's development are in a necessary order? Do you think that he dealt with history and then power and then sexual ethics and identity as a natural progression of his thought? Obviously, every person is dealing with ideas and refining them throughout history. But I'm more interested in seeing, could these have been reordered arbitrarily? Or are they necessarily feeding into one another?
I think I probably want to split the difference between those two. I don't think there's some cast iron necessity that sort of drives his thought forward, making it the sort of big overarching story that he rejects in his own view of history. But I wouldn't want to say that, you know, you choose whichever one you want first and there's no difference. I think it makes sense to develop an understanding of history and historical progress or historical rupture to begin with. And then in the middle stage, which tends to get called his genealogical stage, he gets more political about that. He's pushing some of the boundaries of his understanding of history a bit more. And then when all of those building blocks are in place, when he's begun to tease out the political consequences of his view of history, then he focuses on this idea of identity and the way that identity is constructed, continuing to draw out its political implications. So it sort of makes sense, but I wouldn't want to sort of set it in amber and say that it could never have been any other way and he was destined to follow this trajectory from the first moment he picked up a pen or anything like that.
Have you encountered, this is an honest question, I'm not a leading question, not that leading questions are dishonest, but have you encountered any biographical studies of Foucault, or perhaps some that pay particular attention to his media involvement? I'd be curious to know whether his involvement with public discourse and his interviews on television, if any of that had any particular, I don't know, helped him or influenced him to choose certain areas of discourse or investigation, because I wonder if they're, you know, if you know that these are the kinds of things that are going on in culture. He's a public intellectual. So I guess I'm curious to know if his media involvement and his public persona, if he's taking cues from some of that domain of his life, which might direct some of his investigation, or if he's just thinking about the things he's most interested in them and then bringing them to the public, or in between.
Yeah, I'm sure that there is a sense in which he's, you know, he's got his eyes open to what's going on in society and what he sees as the blind spots of society, and he's certainly responding to them. I don't think he's sort of working in an ivory tower that's completely disengaged from what's happening in the society around him. By no means. He's got very strong political investments, and so there's certainly some of that. I would want to say, though, that there's a trend in Foucault scholarship to reduce his contributions to his biography.
Really?
And this has happened once or twice, that people have written books on him and they've said, well, you know, he would say that because this is who he is. And I really think that sells him short, but also it sells any thinker short. And it's sort of the golden rule at this point. You know, it's, would you like someone to do that to you? To take everything that you say and say, well, yes, you would say that, of course, because of who you are. I think I would want people to say, well, engage with what I'm saying, regardless of why it is that I'm saying it. Let's talk about the substance rather than just sort of dismissing it all on the basis of, well, that's who you are. So obviously you'd say that sort of thing. And I think we do Foucault a disservice. Now, I'm not suggesting you were doing this just now, but people have in the past, and so it's worth pointing it out.
Yeah, that's an important
when
point.
We say, oh, he only says that stuff because of his own particular situation, his own particular identity or whatever. I don't think that's a healthy way of engaging with what someone says.
No, I don't either. I'm curious, though, because some people might be attracted to him purely because of who he was. I mean, and that is fashionable nowadays to read and to find marginalized voices and to hear what they have to say because they offer a perspective on the course of events or on life that we wouldn't otherwise hear. There was a recent dust-up with Miss Gorman, the youth poet laureate of the United States. She's an African-American. She's a tremendous poet. She spoke at President Biden's inauguration, but I believe there was somebody contracted in the Netherlands, a white man, to translate her poetry into Dutch, and received so much criticism because he's not black and neither is he American, can't understand that context, therefore should not be contracted or allowed to translate poetry. Not to get into the aspects of that dynamic, but it just is an example of our cultural, our episteme, should I say, at the moment, where these are kinds of questions where 50, 100 years ago, maybe, these wouldn't have been issues. And we are hearing a variety of traditionally marginalized voices in large measure. It's good to hear from a wide range of people. And so I could see why people might be attracted to Foucault, but in that case, they're seemingly doing maybe the opposite of what he intended, just because he was, in terms of his personal lifestyle and morality, at the time, a much marginalized figure.
Yeah, and I think as Christians, we need to pick through these ideas carefully, don't we? It's very easy to jump on one of two bandwagons, either to say the only thing that matters is what is said, not who says it. And therefore, you know, that ends up with a position like, it doesn't matter that there aren't any or many mm-hmm. black female directors in Hollywood. The only thing that matters right. is that we make good films. Mm-hmm. And then on the other side, you can sort of jump on a bandwagon that seems to so fixate on a person's situatedness that nothing else seems to matter anymore. And I think both of those would sell a biblical view of identity short. And just to briefly unpack what that might look like, I think it's striking, isn't it, that the Bible is written in a series of different situations, nomadic community under the law in the land, a community under occupation, that it's written in plural languages. That's really odd for a major religious text. You know, two major languages and then little bits of Aramaic splattered in there. And also that in Revelation 7, that there's a sense of different ethnic identities persisting into the new creation. So these are not simply an unfortunate effect of the fall. There's the every tribe, tongue, and nation around right. the throne.
You know,
this is what is transfigured in the new creation. And so I think that the Christian has a quite a complex basis there for addressing these issues and saying that these are factors in our identity, our gender, our ethnicity, and so forth, that they're not simply ephemeral, they're not to be discounted. And having voices, and we see this in theology, don't we? You know, the idea that theology is controlled by a particular sort of ethnicity, that theology is white or whatever, is incredibly reductive. And there are wonderful African theologies that are bringing things out of the Bible that were there all the time, but are bringing them out that white people have tended to miss. And so there's a exultant proliferation of perspectives that come from different situatednesses that's both reflected in the biblical text and we can see today in theology. And yet the Bible is very careful never to view people through the single lens mm-hmm. of their situatedness. You know, I'm thinking, for example, of the verse in Galatians where Paul says, you know, there is neither male nor female, slave nor free now. We all are one in Christ Jesus. And I think that this complex position is able to pick through these contemporary debates in a way that neither fractures society into opposing camps that just shout at each other, which is what sometimes we end up getting, but is also able to value the richness, the exciting richness of these different identities, without making them into something, without weaponizing them, I guess, essentially. And I just think that's really exciting about
too.
The Bible, that we've got something fresh and something healthy to say into these really important debates that are happening in society at the moment.
Amen. Yeah, I agree. And sometimes it's helpful to lead with that, at least speaking of apologetic strategy, than it is merely to lead with the opposition. Now, we have to speak truth where we need to speak truth, especially when the culture is presenting an unbiblical ethic and is upholding things that they say are virtuous, which God abhors. Nevertheless, There are also ways in which we can continue to speak the truth in love, not just speak the truth, but also speak the truth in love without compromising that truth. And those are some very extremely helpful themes in Scripture that we can see a tremendous diversity and the unity that we have in plurality in Christ, that He is our identity, but it doesn't obliterate who we are or who we were or in a sense of destroying our enculturedness, our situatedness, our enfleshedness in this life. We all come from a different place, and God meets us and brings us into His kingdom from wherever that place may be, out of darkness into His light. But we can shine that light also in our specific contexts and situations. So let's talk then more. I'd love for you to unfold or unpack even more specifically the Foucault's notions of sexual ethics and specifically identity, even in general. There's so much to be said here, but where does Foucault begin and how does he develop this throughout his later writings?
Yes. Prepare to forget everything you thought you knew about yeah. identity.
Yeah, you I mean, are not even history, you.
Everything you thought history was is wrong. Everything you thought power was is yeah. wrong. And so lo and behold, everything you thought about identity is about to be overturned, according to Foucault. So he starts off with this idea that we have of Victorian sexuality. And if I mention the term Victorian sexuality, most people think, oh, terribly repressive. We don't talk about sex. We pretend it's not there. He calls that the repressive hypothesis. And he says that that is 180 degrees wrong. What actually happened, he says, in the Victorian period, is that there was what he calls a discursive explosion. There was a proliferation of language about sex. And he particularly focuses on four groups of people about whom language was invented in this period, he says. Mm. We've got the hysterical woman, the masturbating child, the perverse adult, and the Malthusian couple. Right. And he says that what happened during this period is that these groups needed regulating in society. And in order to do that, you need a language to speak about them. So languages were developed to talk about these groups in order that they might be regulated in society. He's got this lovely crisp quote from the first volume of His History of Sexuality. He says, "It was time for these figures, scarcely noticed in the past, to step forward and speak, to make the difficult confession of who they were." And this idea of confession, which he gets from Catholic Christianity, is central to Foucault's idea of identity and sexuality. So he says that the Catholic Church predominantly developed this idea of confession that is speaking your deepest desires. Taking what is most fundamentally you, if you like, what is really deep down in you, and vocalizing that. And he says that that has transformed itself into the paradigm of our society. He says we live in a confessing society. So, you know, back in the day, people used to do it to the priest. He says, well, now we do it to the psychoanalyst. Now we do mm-hmm. it on television talk shows. This idea of speaking your identity, of confessing who you are, he says, characterizes our society. It doesn't simply register something that was there all along, but it actually constructs for Foucault the identity. So you become who you are in talking about it. There's an active mm-hmm. role to this confession.
That is very prescient. We see that all the way. I mean, if ever he was right about or putting his finger on something in society, maybe that's it.
Yeah, I think it's incredibly productive as a thought. And how about this? He takes this idea of confessing who you are, and he says that that is what is happening in coming out stories, for example, mm-hmm. when you're constructing your identity. In terms of a particular sexuality. But here's a quotation that I came across years ago that's really, really resonated for me and I think is incredibly helpful in understanding both Foucault and contemporary society. And I'll just read it out. He says, "We expect our intelligibility, so our understanding of who we are, to come from what for many centuries was thought of as madness." And he's talking about what today we construct as sexuality. He says, "Our identity comes from what was perceived back in the day as a nameless urge. Hence," he says, "the importance we ascribe to it, the reverential fear with which we surround it, the care we take to know it." And this was the key sentence that really leapt off the page and slapped me between the eyes when I first read it. "Hence," he says, "the fact that over the centuries, it has become more important to us than our soul."
Hmm.
So what he's saying is we used to have this idea of the very deepest me, the inviolable me, is my soul.
Right, right.
And of course, we as a society don't really believe that anymore. We don't think we have a soul, broadly speaking.
No.
But that's left a bit of a gap. So what is the deepest me, that the inviolable heart of me? And Foucault is arguing here that what's stepped into that gap is what today we construct as our sexuality. That is taking the place that the soul used to take in our understanding of identity. And I just think that's incredibly helpful because it helps to explain and it helps us to appreciate the huge emotional investment that there is in discourse around sexuality and the way in which it generates very heated debate very quickly. And I think if we think of sexuality in terms of that is what people understand to be their soul, it becomes easier to see why the debate is so heated around it.
What might be said or how does this compare with certain forms of existentialism, like something from Jean-Paul Sartre, for example? You know, rather than saying that essence precedes existence, your existence precedes essence, so you can make what you are. I mean, that's a very simplistic way to put it, but if society doesn't, you know, is discounted or jettisoned, gotten rid of the soul altogether, and you are what you confess, you can construct your own being, so to speak. We see that a lot these days. Is that a form of existentialism, merely formal similarity, or is this something drastically different?
Foucault and Sartre are fellow travelers in that quite restricted way.
Yeah.
They really did not like each other more broadly. So Sartre has this Marxist view of history, certainly yeah. in his later work. And he, with his characteristic wit, lampooned Foucault. He said, oh, Foucault is taking us back from the moving pictures of the cinema to the magic lantern. That was his view of Foucault's history, just these static pictures. He said, you can't, there's nothing politically valuable in that. This is regression. So they disagreed fundamentally in certain ways, but in this particular way, in the idea that our identity isn't given to us, but it is constructed. They would say it's constructed in different ways, but yeah, they would agree on that. And I think this is a really important thing to understand about Foucault. And it means that he aligns in slightly surprising ways, perhaps, with concepts that we have knocking around today. So, for example, he had no time at all for sexual liberation. That might sound quite odd. Surely, if anyone's for sexual liberation, it would be someone like Foucault. But he says no, because liberation assumes that there's some essence of me that needs freeing, that's oppressed and just needs letting out. And he said, that's not the way that sexuality works. It's not that there's some unchangeable essence of me. It's that I construct my identity. And he says the idea of liberation just obscures that fundamental truth that identity is created rather than simply allowed to manifest itself authentically.
Just for context as well, you can imagine Foucault was very engaged in and interested and a key kind of thought leader in a lot of what was going on in the gay scene in the late 70s and early 80s out in San Francisco and among other places. And so that is in ways not unexpected if you understand what he's saying, but on the surface would be a rather kind of shocking comment that he wouldn't be for sexual liberation, but in some ways a much more subversive proposition because he's suggesting something that's rather even more drastically different than what we might expect. And there's so much on these points, it might seem odd for me to even ask, but I was just reading a brief article in the journal First Things, and it raised some of the questions about Foucault. And how might you answer this? Was Foucault an atheist? What might you say to such a question?
Let's come at it first of all through his work. He's very conspicuously not concerned with what people believe. And this is another feature of his way of doing history. He's only worried about what people do. So what Christians believe about creation, fall, redemption, not interested. What they do in the confessional, the practices that construct them, that's where his interest is. So intellectually, he's not interested in questions like atheism, because his is a philosophy, his is a history that focuses on practice, not on belief.
That's interesting.
Just very sort of mechanically, he professes no belief himself in his public writing. But I think I would want to push beyond that and sort of tease apart the idea of what it means to be an atheist. And I guess part of it would be trying to construct one's view of the world using resources that don't rely on religious concepts or on religious shapes of thinking. And I think there it becomes very much harder to pin him down. So, for example, the way in which he sees confession as now characterizing our societies, is that an atheistic thing, given that this grew up in a very specifically Christian context and expressed a Christian understanding of reality? I think at that point it becomes much harder to say that conceptually he or indeed anyone is rigorously atheist, even if they profess not to have faith. And I guess this sort of comes back to Nietzsche, doesn't it, and the death of God. It's one thing to say you don't believe anymore, but it's another thing to follow that through and construct a view of the world that no longer relies in any way on the legacy of belief.
Yeah. It's interesting, Foucault's relation with the Catholic Church, too, because he wasn't a Catholic. He might have been when he was a child. I'm not certain if he was baptized. But even later in life, I mean, he frequently read and researched in a theological library, I think it was, or a monastery or something of the sort. And I believe when he passed away, he donated a significant amount of money to support that institution. So whatever his relation, whatever his personal beliefs were about the immaterial, about whether there was a God or not, he wasn't so vitriolically opposed to people of faith that he didn't interact with them. But the question of his belief is certainly interesting.
Tom Holland has showed us recently in Dominion, hasn't he?
Oh, that's a great book.
You can't really study the history of the West with any seriousness and not engage in depth with Christian ideas.
Certainly. But I mean, he even seemed to have some cordial and friendly relationships with people of faith, with Catholics, at least specifically. And, you know, the tendency can be to read Foucault as just evil, bad guy. And no matter how unbiblical his views might be, you know, people, he's not coming in with a Grim Reaper costume and and weapons. He engaged. And all that's to say, it's complex, his situatedness in life. Was he a relativist? Would that be a fair moniker for him? How would you describe his relationship to that typical category that people use to describe some of these types of thinkers, these postmodernists?
Yeah, I think it's easy to use it glibly. There's a sense in which he is, but there's also, I think, a really important sense in which you can't quite put him in that category. So what does it mean for someone to be a relativist? They're saying that all understandings of truth and reality are all values historically are not sort of measured against some absolute standard. And in that sense, I think it's fair enough to say that he's a relativist. But relativity also requires some common measure between, so for something to be relative to something else, I've got to be able to measure it against the thing, you know. So a big chair is big relative to a little chair. But what is a big chair relative to the number three? Well, it doesn't make sense. Like, what do you mean, what is a big chair relative to the number three? You can't measure those two things against each other. It's not bigger, it's not smaller. And I think it's this notion of incommensurability, that two things can't be measured against each other, that's probably cuts more with the grain of what Foucault's doing. So in these different epistemes, as you move from the Renaissance period through the classical period to the modern period, I think he would say you're just on a fool's errand if you try and measure them against each other. And therefore, they're not really relative to each other in any way that you can say, you know, this is better or worse or more adequate or less adequate. They're just different. And in that sense, he's not a relativist, I think we'd want to say.
A good portion of the book, of course, is not merely descriptive. There's great value in diagnosing and describing Foucault's thought, but the wonderful thing about this book and your other books as well, the one on Derrida I'm thinking of specifically, but more generally, your book Thinking Through Creation, Genesis 1 and 2 as Tools of Cultural Critique. We have a previous conversation on that back on episode 591, to which I will link in the episode description. You're certainly presenting also a way of interacting with and addressing matters through a biblical worldview and bringing the Bible into conversation and seeing how that addresses these matters. How can Christians rightfully, what are some suggestions or encouragement you may have for addressing some of these ideas that Foucault presents, but doing so through a biblical position?
This is where it gets really, really interesting. And I think for Christians engaging with these sort of ideas, this is where you really roll your sleeves up and drink a good strong coffee and prepare to do some digging in the Bible and to discover some new things. And so what I found as I was trying to grapple with Foucault and say, well, what on earth would the Bible say to this? Is that very often you find that looking at people like you, Foucault pushes you to see things in the Bible that you might have missed otherwise. I don't know if we've got time to go through all of these three areas, history, power, and identity. But in each of them, if you understand carefully what Foucault is doing, and then you say, well, where does the Bible fit into that picture that he's painting? What you find is that the Bible rearranges his fundamental categories. So often Foucault and other thinkers like him will give you two options. Let's take history for an example. So Foucault's got this idea of smooth, continuous history that he sees in Marx and in Hegel, that history is building towards a great crescendo and it's all one big story. And he's got this other option, which is history as rupture, that he gets from Nietzsche and Bachelard, and that's his own understanding of history. And you say, okay, well, look, where does the Bible fit in relation to those? And what became apparent was that it's reduces to neither. Biblical view of history reduces to neither of those options, really, but it takes elements of each of them and rearranges them into a more complex whole than either of Foucault's two options. And this is a move that I've called diagonalization. All I mean by that is that it cuts across the dichotomous options that are offered and actually shows you a more complex truth that rearranges these options and shows you how both of Foucault's options are actually, in a sense, biblical heresies, in that they take part of a biblical truth and they cut it off from the rest and present it as the whole truth, which is sort of your classic heresy, isn't it? That's what heresies do. And so what I think the Bible does with history that's really exciting and really subversive to a Foucauldian view of it's either continuous or it's a rupture, is this idea that theologians call the great reversal. So it's the idea that God upends the linear or natural progress of things at key moments in history. So for example, the moment where God just cuts into Noah's life out of the blue. You know, Noah's an idolater like everyone else, and suddenly Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. And you think, where did that come from? What on earth is going on? That's not the natural outfolding and unfolding of you know, what was happening before. That is something completely left field. And also the way that God upends the normal sort of way that power works itself out in the world. You know, he systematically chooses the little weak one over, you know, the firstborn, or he chooses David to be the man after his own heart, and Saul, the big, strapping, muscular hulk of a king, shows himself to be not the sort of king that God wants. And of course, ultimately, God saves the world not through some dramatic military conquest, as we would expect. You know, that is the way that you gain power, but through the weakness and in 1 Corinthians 1 terms, foolishness of someone dying on a cross.
Yes.
And
yes.
So you've got these ruptures of a nice, smooth, linear progression. But in the Bible, you've also got a sense of an unfolding story. It's not just a series of ruptures with unconnected little snapshots of history in between them, that there is still this narrative of creation, fall, redemption, and consummation. But not in any linear, not in any predictable, oh, of course it would happen like that, wouldn't it? Yes, if you start with creation, you're bound to end up with the cross. The cross is the last thing that you would think of ending up with. So there's this notion of rupture that is so precious to Foucault, but not in a way that completely gets rid of a sense of a pattern of history. But that pattern is no longer linear progress. Eschatology, to get geeky for a moment, is not teleology. It's not just that things get better and better and better and better until they get perfect at the end. And so the Bible's complex view of history marries elements of both the history of linear progression and the history of rupture in a way that shows both of those, both the position that Foucault takes and the one that he rejects, to be reductive in relation to a much more full-orbed, complex biblical view of history. And I think looking at Foucault's options pushes you towards seeing that in the Bible, whereas otherwise you might not realize that all of those complexities in the biblical account that have been there all along.
I haven't done a very good job of budgeting our time to get through all the material, but I do, of course, want people to check out the more extended treatments on Philippians 2, and you already mentioned 1 Corinthians 1 on this point, because those are very helpful and key programmatic texts for how Christians ought to think and interact with the world. And we think of the mind of the servant, and we don't have what we would expect in Philippians 2, but rather Christ, the King, and who is God himself, humbled himself, taking the form of the servant in order to redeem us. So this movement of humiliation to exaltation, and then also the complete and different dynamics of power that we have in 1 Corinthians, how the Lord sees the world versus how humans often see it, how the world sees it. There's a lot to be said there and a lot to be addressed. Before I ask you and I get you to explain a little bit about your current fellowship, I want to give you time to do that. I'm wondering if you might share with us what you have gained by studying Foucault. Has anything surprised you? What are some aspects that you are grateful for that have helped you in further consideration in other areas, etc.?
That's a really helpful question. I guess that there are probably two things to say about that. First of all, that there are insights in Foucault about the way that society works and the way that people think that he's extremely helpful in expressing. For example, this idea of power isn't just top-down. He says you must cut off the head of the king. What he means is that we shouldn't just think of power as coming down from above, but understand it in a much more capillary way. It's just really helpful for understanding contemporary society and all the identity stuff as well. It's a confusing time identity-wise, isn't it, in our society? And yet Foucault brings into focus and makes clear a lot of the underlying structures that lead people to think in the way that they do today. And I think that's incredibly insightful and helpful. So there's stuff in Foucault that is just really helpful to know for understanding where we are in society today. I think the second thing I'd say is that I've really learned lots of new things in the Bible as well. You know, when you start off with a Foucauldian view of history or a Foucauldian view of power, and you think, okay, how would the Bible speak to this? It sends you digging with questions and in ways that you might not go digging otherwise. And you think, oh my goodness, you know, the biblical view of history is really quite exciting and enriching and profound. And you know, the biblical understanding of power is incredibly subversive. You know, with a level of being radical in that subversion that even puts Foucault's idea of power on the sort of shelf of conventionality. And it's people like Foucault, I think, push us to go digging in the Bible with in a way that we might not otherwise do, and to find things there, you know, that are quite fresh and amazing, and do speak into these ideas that are animating society at the moment with a distinctive voice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think people, sorry, I'm going on a bit, but I think it's really important. People have the sense, and it is often true, that Christianity is a known quantity. Oh, I know what Christians are going to say about X, Y, or Z. I've heard it 1,000 times. But I think there is such riches in the Bible and such complex understandings of things like history and identity and power, that often Christianity is the fresh voice at the table. It's the position that people haven't heard yet. And it's taking thinkers like Foucault and they say, how can I bring the Bible into conversation with this, that sometimes unlocks or opens our eyes to those fresh, complex biblical ways of dealing with these things.
Tell us about your fellowship here and your work on the social contract. Can you explain what that is? I know that you mentioned earlier before we started your research and looking at perhaps a couple books on the subject, but I'd love to hear about this because some people might be excited.
Yeah, it's a four-year research project where I'm spending most of my time trying to understand what the social contract is, this thing that we call the social contract, how it breaks down, and what makes it strong, essentially. So it's come out a lot recently, hasn't it? The COVID crisis has been framed often in social contract language. How dare these people go out into the street without masks? They're breaking the social contract and so mm-hmm. forth. And of course, in the Black Lives Matter protests, there are a number of very evocative, very powerful appeals to the social contract. On social media and in the mainstream media as well. You know, our social contract is broken and so forth. And so it's a language that we use regularly to talk about something fundamental in society that we expect to be there and that we need to be there. It's more fundamental than laws and regulations. It's not just about explicit statute. It's something like the idea that there's a common good in society, that both me and you are better off living together, even if that means we should give up some of our natural freedoms, mm-hmm. than we would be in the forest by ourselves, fending for ourselves. And this idea that there is this better togetherness, and that the trust that is required for that, I need to trust you, you need to trust me, the sense of mutuality, the sense of engagement in society, all these values that you can't codify in law, but that are necessary for the law to work, is I think what we're getting at with this idea of the social contract. And I'm looking at how the social contract relies on particular mechanisms in society to keep it going. So if you look at biblical covenants, for example, you know, God doesn't just give the law once and then let the people get on with it. Right. There are rituals, there are liturgies, there are ceremonies that are intended to keep this fresh in people's minds and to keep people realizing why they're doing what they're doing. And I think this idea that the social contract needs tending to, it needs reinforcing in civic ways, I think is really important. And that it relies on these pre-legal, these infrastructural ideas like trust and mutuality. I'm just trying to get at those and see how those things are built in society. And finally, I guess, where are we with the common good at the moment? You know, there's a sense that's often articulated that our society is more and more and more fractured. It's different groups that have very little in common with each other, often don't even hold the same truths in common, have different understandings of the way the world works,
right,
having at each other and this fracturing of society. So where does that leave the idea of the common good? Can we reconstruct or rescue the idea of the common good within that sort of society?
Wow. This is all fascinating. I'd love to love to talk more about that. Hopefully, in years to come, hopefully not too many, we can experience and reap the fruits of your labor there, but it all sounds tremendous. Again, we've only really scratched the surface. There's so much to talk about here on Foucault, but I do want to encourage people to get a copy here of the book in the Great Thinker series, as well as the books on Jacques Derrida and Gilles Deleuze, as well as the one we discussed previously, or at least one of the books we discussed previously. You can pick up Thinking Through Creation, Genesis 1 and 2 as Tools of Cultural Critique. There's a lot out there. I'll have links to all of these things in the episode description. But Chris, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me today and sharing these things with our listeners. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a real joy for me. Thank you, Cam.
You bet. Well, I encourage people to visit us online. You'll find information about all of these resources embedded within the episode description. So even if you get the podcast downloaded automatically to a smartphone or something of the sort, it's always beneficial and useful to get over to the website and click around on the various items. And, of course, check out PNR Publishing and all the things that they're doing. But until next time, we hope you join us again here next time on Christ the Center.